to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you. I'm really honored and grateful about the invitation to come here, and I'm going to take the offer that I got from Amr, which I assume comes from Berkman, seriously, that this is room for kind of work in progress feedback. So the paper that Dana mentioned that you can get through the announcement page, I'll kind of talk through a bit of that just in sort of 5 minutes or so, and then spend the rest of the time thinking about things that I'm doing in the next piece, which are much less thought through. So I really do welcome, this is me sort of venturing into an area that some of you may have been spending a lot of time in already, but hopefully I can bring a particular perspective to it, and the discussion can follow. So thank you for that. I'm in the communication department at Cornell University. I'm also in the information science program and the science and technologies department. And my work up until recently has dealt with digital copyright, some of the controversies over the last 10 years or so, some of the questions about DRM approaches, legal approaches, and trying to bring kind of a sociological perspective to these sort of legal and economic debates, that while we're having specific debates about how the law should apply to this case or that, what we're doing is we're asking questions about how public discourse should be structured. And copyright was one of those environments where some of those questions were coming to a head, and especially how those decisions are being made in both a sort of legal sense, in a cultural and sort of practical sense, but also in sort of technological forms. And the argument in the book was that, in fact, you can't understand any of those in isolation, that if you study DRM, you have to think about the cultural formations beneath it, the laws that back it up. If you study the DMCA, you have to think about the economics behind where it came from, and trying to get kind of a macro picture on those pieces. So the work since then has been trying to say, okay, that might have been a case study, and if we want to continue to think about how we structure cultural discourse and how we're doing that in a new media environment, then how do we ask those questions on an even sort of broader scale? And I got interested in thinking about online media platforms and how they are increasingly taking the role of curators of public discourse. And let me just start with a sort of moment. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but just to give a feel for where some of these providers are. So this was a press release that YouTube released in December of 2008. As you read along, you'll see the irony of it titling it a YouTube for All of Us, where they're announcing that they've decided that they're going to be a little bit stricter about indecent, inappropriate, profanity, sort of sexually suggestive content. So they've already been enforcing rules about pornography and about, you know, what you might call sort of soft pornography, but they were going to go a little further. They were going to say, we're going to be a little more conservative. They're trying to protect their community. And they announced sort of three tactics for doing that. One is they'll remove some videos, which they've been doing, but they'll sort of remove more than they had been before. Two, they'll move certain videos behind kind of an age barrier, so you have to prove that you're 18 by sort of checking. And if you're not logged in, they assume that you haven't proven that you're 18, so it sort of puts videos behind a little age firewall. And then the third one, which I found really interesting, and I'll come back to at the end of my little discussion, which was they were going to algorithmically demote certain videos so that they would not appear on the most popular lists, the favorited lists, the most discussed, the most viewed lists. So they'd still be in the archive, but they wouldn't show up on those lists. And I thought this was a very interesting combination of sort of motivations and tactics. So thinking about, you know, on the one hand, some pretty traditional moves. You might think about broadcasters and publishers saying, you know, certain things we consider inappropriate. They're not legally pornography or legally obscenity, but they're things that we're not going to include on our network. Age barriers, whether it's ratings or putting things after 10 p.m. or however you want to do it, putting it on, you know, late night cable. And then kind of this third tactic about technically managing where things appear. And I thought it raised a question for how we bring traditional questions about how commercial providers curate, regulate, and constrain the cultural discourse that they host, that we don't really have a language for how these interventions work in a new media environment. And this is the point in a more public talk where I talk about the way that my undergrads We're very comfortable doing making the argument about how Disney makes decisions or the New York Times make decisions, and that's going to shape what makes it on the front page or what makes it on, ABC's nightly TV schedule. And then I said, what about Google? And they said, well, Google just gives us what we put out on the web. And they just didn't have a way to bring that very same argument to this environment and think about Google's business model and Google's legal liability and Google's sort of interest in protecting its own brand. So I thought this would be a relevant question for new media scholars and legal scholars to be tackling. I apologize. So the slides for this talk are for if I were doing the public version. So you may see me sort of like bump, 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 like skip a bunch of things. They're all things you know and you don't have to worry about, and we'll get right to the meat of the things. But so I would ask this question. How do we take the tradition of asking questions about how commercial information providers shape public discourse, why they do it, and what are the implications for doing so? With the base assumption, I don't think this would be sort of surprising to this audience, that these providers, especially the most sort of prominent ones, the most public ones, are playing a role in deciding what ends up online, what ends up being viewed, what ends up popular. And not just whether it's there or not, but also whether it's visible, whether it's seen by a lot of people, how it's seen, and in what context. And so we can bring these questions to this new media environment, but the role that they play is somewhat different than the way broadcasters might have managed content, the way publishers might have managed content. So how do we ask the same underlying question, but then understand and pay attention to the differences about how this business works? And I highlight up there sort of three ways we might begin to think about. So obviously, curating user-generated content, not just professionally solicited content, or increasingly both, right, a sort of mix of both, and which might be complicated. The second one, which I find sort of interesting, if the newspapers or the broadcasters or the movie studios, if their business was, there's all sorts of content that does or could exist in the world, and we're going to select from it the best, the most popular, the most newsworthy, the most intriguing, whatever criteria they use, then that gatekeeping role was part of our investigation as legal and cultural scholars. What does that gatekeeping do? What's left out? What are the criteria by which things are included or excluded? Google and YouTube and Flickr and Facebook and MySpace do have a different business model, right? There is an imperative for a service like Google to have as many things available as they can. So they want the search to look like it covers the entire web, to feel like it covers the entire web. They want their book collection to have everything, if possible. So much so that they're willing to push the law and create an opt-out situation rather than opt-in, which would have been a much safer legal arrangement. Because for them to be able to say, this is every book, right? Or to say, this at least has the semblance of every book is better for their business, both for users and for advertisers. So they're in the business of comprehensiveness, which changes why they would include or exclude. It doesn't mean they don't exclude, but it changes how they would do it. And then a third one, which in some ways has a sort of temporal quality, as a Facebook or a MySpace or a YouTube grows, how does it manage both catering to the kind of niche communities that gave it its initial strength, and at the same time being YouTube or being Facebook, whether that's brand, guarding a brand, whether it's convincing advertisers that they have, 20 million eyeballs and not sort of seven, right, who happen to like this particular kind of video. So the tension between keeping those niche communities, which are often active, outspoken, have very particular politics about the kinds of things that they want to represent, and this kind of, what does YouTube look like to the public? What does YouTube look like as an entire service? Okay, so sort of three questions. And again, the first paper that you can read, I would love feedback, deals with this first question. So how do these sites promise to be everything and not everything at the same time? Where is this rhetoric of the complete service come from? Where's the rhetoric that convinces my students that these are neutral, non-interventionist providers come from? How have they cultivated this notion? Second question, if in fact that is a sort of strategic or a characterization of the issue that is not a good representation of the fact that there are choices being made, how do these sites intervene? What do they provide or not provide? What are their justifications and their techniques, and what are the implications of that? And then the third question, this is the one I sort of don't dare to tread on because I know the literature, but not like some of the people in this room. I think this, obviously situates us back into a question of free speech and a long tradition of asking, if you think of free speech as a rule that doesn't just apply to the government, but also has some kind of obligations for the commercial and private providers whether it's CBS or the New York Times or Facebook. How do we think about their role? What is our notion of free speech that would or would not allow us to create obligations? If so, what? How would we cultivate a robust public discourse? What do we mean by that, and how does that play out in real scenarios? So let me start with the first question. And again, if you see me sort of moving, going in too deep, tell me to speed up so we can get right to the conversation. So the question is, what is it about the promises made by these sites that make them appear neutral? And this is where, for me, the kind of theoretical work that comes out of communication sociology is helpful. That, you know, I think of the work that an organization like YouTube or an organization like Flickr and Yahoo, organization like Facebook does, is not just economic, we're building a business, it's not just technical, we're building a service that works on a certain kind of infrastructure, but it's also discursive work. So how do they articulate their service? How do they sell themselves to various stakeholders, whether it's users, whether it's their advertisers, their media partners, whether it's lawmakers, such that they can define what it is that they are and are not, that they can set the terms by which they are judged, set the terms by which they are regulated, and achieve a couple of goals. So obviously building a financially viable business, both in the moment and in the future, but also when speaking to lawmakers, thinking about how to seek the regulations they want and avoid the liabilities they don't. It's a very sort of careful balance. And then set the terms on a sort of a public basis on how they are judged. So in the paper, I make hay out of the term platform. And the point is not to say that having adopted this term, that somehow changes the conversation radically. It's more like the role that this term plays is indicative of the kind of positioning that a YouTube or a Flickr or a Facebook would like to establish themselves. To me, this is a kind of, there's a concept that that Charles Bazeman talks about, a discursive resting point. So these kind of terms that come out of existing conversation, they aren't manufactured sort of wholesale, but they end up playing a very powerful role in characterizing a particular service or a particular arrangement. They do a lot of discursive work for the stakeholders involved. These are terms that don't just sort of drop from the sky. They don't emerge organically from conversation. They're actually drawn from the available vocabulary by stakeholders who have specific aims, and they're carefully massaged to have particular resonance for particular audiences inside of particular discourses. And again, it's not that this word itself, but more why this word has sort of fit so comfortably in the self-characterizations of these sites and also the public characterizations of these sites. So in the paper, if you want to spend time with it, I kind of play around with the history of this term. So obviously, when YouTube talks about itself as a platform, and it very clearly started referring to itself as a platform just after the Google sale. It talked about itself as a community, as a service, as a website, and it continued to do that, but it very regularly talked about itself as a platform. And a number of these services like that term. There's some dispute online as to whether it's a valid use of the term. Tim O'Reilly thinks it's fantastic. Mark Andreessen thinks it's a violation. The term draws on the sort of computational meaning, right? An infrastructure upon which tools can be built. And what Mark Andreessen says is that ain't what YouTube is. If someone calls their service a platform and you can't build a tool on it, you tell them you're using the term wrong. Nevertheless, we talk about these sites as platforms all the time. Media sharing platforms, blogging platforms, wiki platforms. So the computational term of an infrastructure upon which tools can be built has been ported over the last decade to all sorts of services that provide content, that provide video, that provide images, that provide text. But I would argue that it's not just drawing on the computational, but it's drawing on much older meanings that this term provides. So the very old one is a kind of architectural, right? Subway platform, an oil rig platform, platform shoes, where you know something lifts something up for the purposes of a particular activity in some sort of vaguely helpful and specific way. Sort of a raised level surface is the Oxford English Dictionary's first definition. We also see the political meaning, right? So your political platform, there are the planks in your political platform. It literally came from standing on a stage, and it increasingly refers to your set of beliefs, your set of issues. And then obviously a figurative meaning. So the architectural one turning into, you know, here's a platform from which I could, you know, go up the corporate ladder. So all of these meanings help this term resonate for a site like YouTube, for a site like Flickr, in characterizing itself as both doing something and also not doing others. And I would say there's a series of connotations that are powerful in this term. So without having to say it, the term invokes a sense that it is is an open space, it is an egalitarian space. Anyone who wants to be on it can be on it. Being on this platform allows you to do something, something of value. And it's a wide and spacious and sort of forgiving, maybe even limitless space from which to act. And what I look at in the paper, and I use YouTube as my example, is thinking about the way that YouTube negotiates quite a mixed and sometimes contradictory set of audiences that they have to present themselves to. And the term platform and the kind of discursive position that they're engaged in manages the conflicts between these communities. So first they're speaking to amateur users, and you know, the whole sort of like broadcast yourself mission of YouTube and the way that they've sort of positioned themselves as champions of user-generated content, the term platform is perfect for that. It's a platform from which to be heard, from which to speak. Kind of the political and the figurative and the structural all together. But their business is not just in getting users to post videos. It's obviously pairing those videos with advertising in some form. And this is no easy task, right? The culture of user-generated content online is ambivalent about the role of advertising. So YouTube has to manage doing both of those things and being both of those things to different audiences. When they speak to advertisers, the term platform works perfectly there too. But it's something different. It's a platform of opportunity. How do you get your brand in front of the right eyeballs, right? A much more traditional mass media promise that YouTube wants to make to their advertisers. YouTube is also involved quite heavily in bringing on media partners. They don't want to just have, you know, the guy getting in the crotch of the football. They want music videos. They want trailers. And so they're also speaking to their media partners. And for them, platform works again, but it's a distribution platform. How are you going to make your work visible among this huge archive, right? A promise not of flatness, but of a tiered structure, right? So your TV show will be prominently displayed. Your music video will be accessible. And then finally, when they're speaking to lawmakers, again, there's this this tricky balance. So when YouTube and Google are talking about net neutrality, when they're talking about their free speech rights, when Senator Lieberman accused them of allowing Islamic terrorist videos on their platform, for them, they are a valuable platform from which people can speak. Without them, without this fragile opportunity, people who need to speak wouldn't get to, right? You know, it's Netta from Iran, right? It's this powerful, you know, regular citizen that, you know, that changes the world, that, you know, political speech from across the globe. When they're talking about liability for copyright infringement, when they're talking about liability for obscenity, they are merely a platform. Right? We simply, you know, it's like we do this or we do this. And it's a wonderful negotiation of a very tricky balance, right? When do you want lawmakers, regulators to step in and offer you protections because of the service you offer? And when do you want them to put the responsibility on the users, let you out of the way? And I would argue that platform as a kind of metaphor, as a structural metaphor, is not unlike the term conduit. And you know, the language that has gone through communication regulation about whether information services should or should not be responsible for the content they deliver. Historically, the telephone companies were able to argue that they're not responsible if you plan a terrorist attack over their networks because they're merely a conduit. And as long as they maintain this conduit relationship, right, they don't know about what's passing through, they pass things through equally, they are just a service to get from point A to point B, then they have a limited liability. And much of this language and this metaphor carried over to internet service providers. So YouTube is in some ways being quite strategic. They're looking for a way to position themselves in that same position. So long as they allow things to move, so long as they make space for things and they don't know about what's going on, then they can claim that they are a platform in a very similar way as Conduit offers. So that's what the paper that exists has done. So for me, the next question is where I'm sort of beginning. How do you begin to find a language for the techniques and the justifications that online media platforms are in fact engaged in when they have to make decisions about what content belongs on their site and what doesn't. And in the longer talk, I would do a tale of content management in three acts. So thinking about Facebook, Flickr, and YouTube as adopting three different strategies. Let me jump right to YouTube, and I'll go back to those in the question and answer if you like. So YouTube maintains, both in interviews and their public statements, that they do not look for content proactively. They only look at content that their users have flagged as potentially inappropriate according to their community guidelines. Now, this is not exactly the case because they do, in fact, look for spam. And it's not likely the case because there are very strict regulations about looking for child pornography. And it's their justification for why they don't, which is there's simply too much material, is a bit of a misnomer because Facebook does it and Flickr does it, and they have an awful lot of stuff too. But YouTube maintains that they are a reactive provider. Users can flag content. When they find a video they think is inappropriate, they can flag it. It brings down a pull-down menu. They indicate sort of which community guideline it violates. Is it pornography? Is it hate speech? Is it violence? Is it drug use? Is it spam? And even some of those specify. And this information goes into a queue that YouTube maintains of all the videos that have ever been flagged. They have pretty complicated algorithms for why things bump to the top. So if you mark it as child porn, it goes right to the top. If things have been flagged a lot by a number of users, or there's ratios between how popular and how many flags. They have a team of people who they're unwilling to tell you how many people they have that are looking at these materials and making decisions. The community guidelines are a kind of folksy, non-legal document about sort of being good on a site. And articulate a series of categories of things that are inappropriate, but in a kind of like, can't we all get along kind of language. And many of these sites offer it in these terms. And what I would argue is that this careful distancing onto the community, which is not exactly what Facebook does and is not exactly what Flickr does, but we're seeing increasingly as a tenable position for these sites to occupy, has what I'm calling a sort of figure eight model of community governance. So this figure eight model is users tell us what's inappropriate according to the community guidelines we drafted, right? Users can comment on the guidelines, but then YouTube can change them or not in response depending on what they see fit. Users can game the system, but YouTube can decide which flags are legitimate and illegitimate, which ones they will listen to and ignore. Users can complain about what's removed, but YouTube can point to the community itself as justification for why those interventions were made. So in the same way that platform positions themselves as a provider of something that they are also distanced from or neutral to or non-interventionist about, this community governance model that refuses the proactive, that distances them from we look for our own criteria and we remove on our own basis, which, you know, Facebook gets in trouble for every time they do it, Flickr gets in trouble for every time they do it. YouTube can rhetorically position themselves as defending the community according to the community norms, right? Which, of course, are structured and crafted with their own legal liabilities and business imperatives in mind. As an epilogue, and I'll leave it at that so we can open up the conversation, I want to come back to our 2008 press release and come back to that last strategy, this algorithmic demotion. So my first thought before I had a chance to talk to anybody at YouTube was, what a weird and clever way to make these videos harder to find, but still have them in the archive, right? So they're there, and you know they're there, but the ways in which some people might find these videos are sort of less available. That's what I thought was going on, and that may be part of what's going on. When you speak to the content policy director at YouTube, the explanation is that the front page of YouTube is automatically populated from those lists. So if you go and you've already registered a user, the first things are sort of recommended by your own viewing habits, but then the next set of things are other videos that might be interesting. Sometimes they're thematic, so on Monday it was Martin Luther King type things, sometimes they're not, and those videos are drawn from most popular. They figure that popularity measure is a pretty good way to get things in front of your eyes that you might want to click on. New users, that page is almost entirely populated automatically from those mechanisms. So to demote these videos from the lists is a way of managing the front page. Those videos will never show up on the front page. And their description was, we don't want a new user showing up at YouTube and finding bikini videos, right? They don't want it to look like a softcore porn site. That stuff is there. They can cater to that audience, whoever wants it, but they don't want that as the first thing that you arrive at, right? They want to cultivate that image. And I think Flickr does this very carefully as well. That front page tells you this is a site for like landscape photography and sunsets and birds and artistry. And there's a lot of dumb party snapshots and there's hardcore pornography and there's all sorts of stuff on that site. You'd never know it from that front page, right? You're like in a world of, I bought my really nice, you know, expensive camera and I'm ready to go out there and shoot the world. So a technical management of what is seen. This to me raises a number of questions about how the technical can be a part of this. So on the one side, I think Amazon, although this is not a sort of content platform, they're in a similar situation. They had a controversy, when was it, a couple of months ago, where all of a sudden a series of gay and lesbian fiction disappeared from the bestseller list, like all at once. And it was pretty clear that it wasn't just all of a sudden people stopped buying this. There were things that were high up on the list and they were just gone. And there was immediately a sort of explosion of criticism on Twitter. And there was, for a while, people thought it was hacked. And then Amazon came out and said, it was a glitch. Someone ticked over a bunch of these books into the adult category, and then they just all disappeared. There's all sorts of interesting insights into how people can critique these decisions. But what I found really fascinating was, so up until that moment, the bestseller list was, in fact, a managed bestseller list. It wasn't simply the most popular books rated by how many books were sold. It was how many books were sold within a category, appropriate books. So porn is out of there, adult, whatever falls into adult just simply doesn't appear. So these mechanisms that are presented as algorithmic, this is simply a measure of what people are doing. And you might want to know what's most popular, and you might want to buy books that are popular, and here they are in fact a socially managed representation of what's being bought through Amazon. The second thing that unfortunately was also Amazon, they made another blunder, you may well know about this, was the decision to remove two books from the Kindle that they were suddenly alerted to that they were worried they didn't have copyright rights to. Sadly and ironically, it was George Orwell, which was just, you know, disastrous for them, but they were able to remove these things from the Kindle, right? So people who had bought these books opened up their Kindle and suddenly they were gone. So it wasn't just on YouTube's platform they remove a video. Now it's in this device that's in your hand that feels like you've purchased and is sort of in your possession. And of course, we're becoming aware of the fact that the things that we carry around, the things that we treat as ours, are not ours in the same way. They might feel like ours, but there's a much more complicated relationship to the provider and the service that can retain rights to these things. So both of those situations raise kind of a fourth story for me, which is the technical as both a management of what you see, a management of the face of the site, which then is a kind of cultural norming of what you're supposed to do there, while still allowing the site to host whatever, right? If you want to go in there and have crazy upside down naked surfboard pictures, you can do that. But the presentation of the service is more carefully cultivated through mechanisms that are relatively invisible to the average user. The second being the removal of things that might feel like ours and part of our collection, but nevertheless retain a more complex relationship to the provider, the platform, the service. So anyway, that's what I'm thinking of, and I understand that the second piece of it especially is just the beginnings of trying to find a vocabulary and find a sort of, how do we take a big snapshot about the realities of content management, the realities of these, you know, drawing lines in the sand for these various providers. But I think especially for a broader and especially for a sociological audience, this is kind of a set of questions that we don't have a vocabulary for, even though the tradition of asking the question is quite strong. So anyway, that's what I have, but I would love to hear what stands out to you.
So I have to say, definitely, I had some trouble accepting things that you said.
Sure.
Just because I think there is a mixture of what type of content we are talking about and what type of content they really have this capacity, this technical capacity of doing a proactive or a reactive action in regard to. And for disclosure, I work in the as an ISP exactly with this type of problem also, but so I'm thinking of developing some kind of graduation or like a curve or something that says, okay, here they really have some kind of technical ability, or there is technical ability in the market to do that. Mm-hmm. And we know that in relation to images is much more problematic than with relation with text. Mm-hmm. And in relation with the Kindle book, the 1984, yep, is much more problematic than with a YouTube video. So maybe like a careful graduation of the technical ability and how this technical ability relate with each kind of content,
right,
may be easier to understand, to say like, mm-hmm, here they really have control, here,
right,
they really do not have control, at least for now.
Mm. Well, so I think that's great. There's a distinction I would want to make. So proactive and reactive is one spectrum. Automatic or algorithmic efforts or not are another. So so there is the question of, like, can you automatically find text, right? You can find the seven deadly words, right? That's a pretty easy thing to do. Finding pornography in images and videos is harder. And we know there are sort of like skin tone recognition mechanisms, but they have all sorts of problems. That's whether the attempt to patrol is automatic, algorithmic, or if you just have somebody sitting in front of a video and saying, I think that's pornography. Proactive and reactive could be either of those. What I'm thinking of as proactive and reactive is, has something been alerted to you, or did you go looking for something? Right? Facebook goes and looks for pictures that it thinks are indecent, obscene, pornographic. It doesn't require someone to have said, hey, this picture looks to me like it's beyond the bounds. YouTube, at least publicly, says it will not do that, right? It will not go fishing for videos that are inappropriate. And this is a very interesting problem, because YouTube's become a sort of big fish in the sea on this. And you know, 4chan loves having porn day, right? And they have it all timed, and all of a sudden, like, thousands of videos are on YouTube, and they look like they're Justin Timberlake videos, except right in the middle there's pornography, and they all are ticked on at exactly the same time. So suddenly YouTube is flush with pornography. And all those videos, like, they're all timed to have been highly recommended, so they're suddenly popping up on the list. And they, you know, they, at least, I mean, there's a skepticism in my own mind. I sort of want to introduce this. According to their claims of what they do, that would only begin to be looked for as those things queued onto their list. Now, once something queues on the list and they start to see, aha, it's porn day, right? Then they begin to look for things with the same tags. I mean, they have, you know, they're allowed to go further than that. But the decision to go looking for things before a user says something. To me, that's so one, you know, one way to map this would be to say, okay, one spectrum is proactive and reactive. One spectrum is sort of human assessment versus algorithmic assessment versus the combination of the two. And those might be a way to think about, you know, strategies they adopt and justifications for said strategies. That's helpful. Yeah.
Can you speak a bit more about the differences? You skipped over your first two acts.
Sure, sure, sure.
Why do you have a hunch as to why you think Facebook adopts the more proactive policy?
I do. I mean, all of the, you know, the people I've spoken to, there's a really interesting combination when they talk about why they do this. You know, I'm always talking to the person whose job it is, so it's not like they can hide the fact that they're making decisions about content. But there's a really interesting mixture of, like, we're committed to free speech, there's the health of the community, you know, there's legal liability, there's sort of economic imperatives, and all those things play into the conversation, but they play in different measures. And what I've been hearing from Facebook, both in interviews and in the sort of public face, is that especially their move to a younger audience. So having gone from, you know, this is university students only, which allows them a kind of, you know, a kind of leeway about content, to alumni of said universities, to members of tech businesses, to high school students, to anyone 13 and over with a valid email, that move to teenagers is a precarious one. And all of them are conscious of the age issue, although they handle it different ways. And I think Facebook's, at least their justification for why they're proactive, is that sense of, we're recently catering to a younger audience, and a feeling like they had to be particularly careful about content for that reason. And photos and third-party apps are relatively new for them too, right? So a Flickr or YouTube that's been doing, you know, visual content all along, Facebook, that's still a relatively new phenomenon for them.
Do you have any sense as to whether they're proactive just on things? active in other things, like malicious third-party applications or spam, this kind of thing. The impression I've gotten from others is that they're not nearly as responsive for that kind of disease.
That's very interesting, yeah. So I've been mostly coming at it in terms of the sort of classic content questions. And clearly part of it is, like, there's all sort of all sorts of technical, you know, sort of online-specific questions, like, you know, viruses and malware and that kind of stuff, where so I don't know how it plays out, whether they're being more proactive on certain things. Certainly, you know, the easy answer is, you know, child pornography is a special category and gets special kinds of treatment because they're under special obligations. So there are decisions made about how quickly to respond to certain kinds of content. But that would be a really interesting question to ask about how they manage that stuff. Yeah.
Just a quick one. Is it possible that the likes of YouTube now think of themselves as an institution,
mm-hmm.
almost like a library? They started out kind of as a big reading room,
yeah.
and now they have a somewhat more curatorial and responsible role to play. So they have to move some of this stuff back and out of sight, kind of down into the stacks. I don't know, but I think there's mm-hmm. I think there's a sense, I get a sense with them from what they're saying of institutional responsibility. Mm. They're now important in a way that we didn't expect to be at first, and this is the kind of stuff that important institutions do.
Maybe. I mean, I think that what I was hearing flat out was, you know, when these two guys started this video site, they didn't really think about these things, right? And a lot of these have a kind of maturation where it's designed for people like them, and it's designed not immediately with sort of legal liability questions in mind. It's designed... Yeah, yeah. So part of it is that it's institutionalization, but it's institutionalization where legal liabilities become visible, audiences get more complicated, public visibility changes. I think some of these sites like YouTube talk a big game about recognizing their importance. I mean, I think that's a part of it, right? And they loved to trump when they played some role in, political communication or what have you. I would think a lot of it. I think one way to think about it is the kinds of metaphoric understandings they have of their own service, right?
Yeah.
So are they kind of like the of the moment? Are they the historical archive? Do they think about those things in different moments and in different ways? Part of what's interesting, I think, is that they're managing a lot of those things, right? They're managing being crazy collections of communities and being everything. They're managing being user content and commercial content. They're managing being political and frivolous. And in different moments, in different ways, they have to figure out their responsibility.
And they're becoming bureaucratized inside. Mm-hmm. Different parts of the bureaucracy are exposed under different conditions.
Right, that's right.
So I want to ask a question from the sky.
Okay, great.
I'll sort of interrupt. I'll just start with one of them. So Wendy wants to know if Tarleton can talk about how he thinks platforms connect to intermediaries, with a particular bent towards the lawyers talk about intermediary liability or immunity, whereas economists talk more about platforms.
Okay. Well, so I've been using the term in some ways, partially as a term that these sites invoke, right? So a self-appointed term, and then partly to kind of give a picture for a very broad collection. So I'm not necessarily distinguishing it from intermediaries, but I imagine that intermediaries, I assume this question means intermediaries like ISPs. So as I understand it, and please, for those who know the law better than me, I'm just chuckle and clarify later. ISPs have a certain protection, whether it's, you know, the 230 rule, the DMCA safe harbor. Search engines get a similar kind of safe harbor, and I think YouTube has been positioning itself as as enjoying that second category, right? So it is like a search engine of its own archive. But it doesn't fit neatly into that definition, even as neatly as Google would. And certainly not as an ISP would. So I think that the metaphoric positioning that platform symbolizes, and that kind of like distancing oneself from users' activity or bringing oneself close to users' activity, has a lot to do with bringing themselves as close as possible to those kinds of safe harbors, whether it's the ISP safe harbors or the search engine safe harbors. That's my sense of it. And it's interesting to look at, like, the YouTube Viacom, all the materials for that case. Viacom never talked about them as a platform. They call them a distributor, right? And that's a powerful term in the position that they want to hold them responsible for not being rapid about their removals.
One way for the the people who provide these platforms to get out of the dilemma would be to provide both a curated and uncurated view of the site, or maybe even to outsource curation to, you know, various people. So, you know, if I don't like your creation, your curation, I'll try hers instead. I don't know how, whether any platform has gone very far down that road, but it seems like one way to resolve the problem so people can sort of be able to select their own level of, you know, what should be censored, what should not be.
That's interesting. So Flickr comes closest to that. It's not different versions of curation, but it's the attempt to have it all and not be visible about having it all. So they try to, they have the sort of the porns in the back approach to content. So there's hardcore pornography. Users are supposed to rate their own images, safe, moderate, or restricted.
Like safe search in Google. Which,
right,
you know,
exactly.
I think it's normally turned on moderate. You can turn it off or
right.
turn it stricter if you want.
That's right, right. So, and they used to call it, they don't use this term anymore, but they used to call it NIPSA, which was not in the public search area. So it was like, how do we keep things in the back room? And so we allow users who don't ever want to encounter this to not even know it's there. People who turn off the safe search mechanism can see these things. So, you know, the way I think about it is sort of like, we always knew in the old video stores that that room was in the back. You didn't go in it, but you kind of knew it was there. Well, now it's like, it's on the shelves, but you can't see it unless you sort of look the right way. What I find really interesting about Flickr's move is that when Germany, Singapore, Korea complained about minors gaining access to unacceptable material, the way they handled it, rather than doing an age verification mechanism, was, okay, if you're coming from that country, you can't turn off the safe search. So it's this question of, like, once you build a tool for one reason, it's very easy to say, well, great, we have that tool and we're just going to do it for another reason. So that means if you are a legitimate adult German user, you can't see any of that stuff, and there's no way to see it from a German ISP.
Why did they do that instead of age verification?
The sense I got was that it was easier. Right, it took a lot less building, but I haven't had a chance to ask them about that directly. There was a lot of controversy about that that move, but that's a way to sort of say there is the unmoderated, and of course it is already moderated, but the relatively unmoderated version, if you can find it, and then there's the protected version that you might encounter. It's not the one of like, I want the Democrat, you know, lens, and I want the church's lens, and I want the NRA's lens. That'd be kind of cool too. But the risk of, you know, all of this is about keeping kids away from the most problematic stuff. And if it's there and kids can find their way to that particular uncurated archive, then you haven't solved the problem.
We're in a pretty confusing time when it comes to terminology, because we're building stuff that doesn't fit very well into the old terminology.
Sure.
So, as you say, platform has a long history, and then it has a geek history, and then that becomes less geeky, and the term gets taken over, and it doesn't actually mean anything very specific,
right.
Although there's a set of implications that and connotations you've been drawing out. So if that's the situation, and if your question is, if you're pointing out the lack of a vocabulary, which I think is really valuable, and I really like the way that you are forcing our attention on the particularities of how sites use terms for very particular reasons. Are you suggesting that we should develop a vocabulary? And if you are suggesting that, how would you do that? I mean, does the observation that we don't have a vocabulary lead to some action that we should be taking, or just increased vigilance when somebody says, oh, it's a platform, we should hear that more carefully?
Right, that's a good question. So the first instinct is that last point, right, sort of vigilance. And I guess my instinct is not... there are sort of artificial problematic vocabularies, and then there are like good, the right vocabularies. I would say all vocabularies are strategic. We just have to think about what the strategy is and what they obscure and highlight. So, and this is my sort of like communication bent, is the first thing is to unpack the terms and recognize that they're doing work, and to see how the connotations matter here, and that they are, you know, may have consequences, right? So this idea of like, if we buy a certain vision of these sites, if we see them as close to the intermediaries, if we see them as, you know, as distanced from what they're providing, then we're more comfortable giving them liability for the things users do. If we see them as hosting stuff, then we hold them more liable. So these impressions might have consequences for how laws form and how expectations form. That said, I guess the second question then is like, what do I do about it? What do we do about it? Part of me is drawn by the question I got first, which is like, all right, let's start to create a criteria. There's proactive, reactive, there's algorithmic, and there's human, right? I don't know if those are the right terms, but that's the beginning of a terminology about the kinds of interventions and the manner of interventions. And then there's a part of me that says, you know, to what extent would that be masking things as well? So is it about imposing a new vocabulary? Is it about maintaining diligence about vocabulary? I think I get the benefit of being in an academic position where I can always mess with the terms. I'm not a, you know, Supreme Court justice where I have to come at the end and say, but it should be this. But I'm torn about the impulses in those directions. It's a very good question. Yeah.
A comment, and I think it ties in with the last two questions as well. So I work as a project manager and a director of community at a media distribution platform that actually feeds Flickr, Twitter, text messages, photos up to public screens, like in Times Square and in locations. Mm-hmm. And I've been there for about 4 years now, and the sort of progression of the vocabulary that we've had to develop has been sort of in a very new industry. It's interesting seeing the terms that you're using, because I think it's very much, when we started, it was, we had an auto filter that was aligned very much with movie type ratings, because that's what people could understand. You send in a text message, it's GRX, we're in a venue, you can pick to be, you know, a G-rated venue, and you only get fed G-rated messages. And then, you know, as more, you know, looking at your model of platform, you know, when advertisers started coming into the mix, it seemed at that exact time that we also became an advertising platform, the word curation sort of popped into the mix. So we have something called a text jockey, and someone's actually there and looking at these messages 24/7. You need a human on this. And we sort of, our vocabulary for it is global ratings versus contextual ratings. So we have those two rating systems. You know, as brands came in and started having rules for every single campaign that were entirely different based on brands. I'm McDonald's, I don't want Burger King on the, like, consider Burger King profanity.
Right.
You know, we had the text jockey, and now we have a curation jockey. So we have rules that are set up for specific campaigns, but then when that campaign is broadcast, maybe in nightclubs in New York City, but also in showcase cinemas where families are around, you have sort of a curation method, but then it also has to filter back through the original, you know, G and X for venue specific. So you have brand specific, and then you have sort of content levels and contextual levels, and then you still have a venue level of rating. So, you know, as this, and then you also have the network that is being broadcast on.
Right.
So we have these, you know, layers of moderation and content filtering that it has to go through. And by the end, you know, it's been years of us sitting there, and as we brought in more social streams, it's just gotten more and more complex of how we handle anything. Like, photos, it needs to be a person looking at it and judging it.
Right. And moderating before it ever appears anywhere.
I mean, because it's things that just can't be automatically rated. And I'll be on phone calls with the legal team of a brand, and they'll say things that make me want to laugh out loud, like, you know, cleavage is okay, but it must have a head in the picture. You know, like, no, it's like,
now it's
listed as tasteful cleavage with head showing. You know, like, it gets to that level of specificity
that,
you know, there's no way this can be just sort of a overall sweep of moderation.
That's,
and it only keeps getting more and more complex as
That's totally fascinating, because I guess because my sort of interest is whatever I think of as like the public discourse, I tend to look at these places that are producing for the public environment. And there's a whole story about the where these other things come from and how they get there. And it's not like, you know, these questions about like drawing these crazy distinctions about cleavage with or with not a head, with or without a head. I mean, we've heard these stories before. You know, American Pie got in trouble because there were four thrusts into the pie and they took two thrusts out and they got their rating, right? So it's like, I guess that's what an R is, right? Too many thrusts into a pie. So we're always, but it's interesting to me that what we can see is on the kind of service that you're talking about, an incredibly complex and, like you said, venue specific and site specific and category specific distinctions, and then these sites, these sort of public platforms, picking and choosing between that strategy, right? So Flickr sort of like, can we cater to, you know, can there be people who want hardcore pornography? Can there be the fetishists? And can there be someone who wants to go there and see like beautiful pictures of flowers? And can they like cohabitate without even knowing that they're there? Or do you have to like make one sort of safe area for every Facebook user, whether or not they're 13 or 30, or they're from Germany, or they're from whatever, you know, like, and those impulses, I think, you know, I can see those sites like struggling. Each one of them sort of poses a problem. YouTube can't cater to a different set of audience if they say a YouTube for all of us.
We're still at the end of the day trying to cater to the end user,
right,
who's saying, you know, I sent in this picture of my 12-year-old in a field of daisies and it was deleted,
right,
and I got a message back that says, sorry, your message has been deleted,
right,
and it's because the brand has said no children under 13 under no circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then you need to send out a generic message saying, sorry,
this
your content,
right,
has been removed,
right,
and not having to send out, you know, when you have a million people engaging with the campaign, sending out a personal email to each one saying,
right,
like, your daughter is lovely in her field of daisies,
yeah,
but the brand has said.
Yeah. And that's why I wonder especially about the ability to sort of algorithmically maneuver, because it
right,
comes closer to that technique, but for the broader model,
mm-hmm,
right? So how do you manage what is visible, what's not visible to different kinds of viewers, and
right,
you know, the ability to discern, I think, is increasing.
We've found, you know, more and more what is what someone finds objectionable is, it's such a vast
right,
spectrum that you just, you could never, it surprises me every time when something, you know, you sort of, it, you cannot keep track of what might possibly be objectionable to a certain person,
right,
especially in some place like Times Square. Every piece of content will be probably objectionable to someone walking by at any point. So
I have another question from back up in the
yeah,
in the question. So this is from Jody. How has the near real-time feedback influenced accountability and the exposure of algorithms and decisions?
Mm.
The Twitter-Amazon fail incident, for instance, Amazon was faced with the decision to respond or not, and then further faced with the decision of what to do about the allegation.
Mm.
And what are these kinds of dynamics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I feel like I'm going to answer it by aping things that I've talked to you about. So I find that Amazon fail issue intriguing because it sort of reveals to me what was going on all along, that just sort of slipped into view. But certainly the response to it, you know, the response to it is faster. The response to it can be made more public. It can be galvanized. I think we can see around a number of these sort of controversies of things that were taken down, a couple things, the speed being a part of it, but the other part of it being users using the platform to critique the platform. And Facebook users have used that, I was about to say very effectively. I don't know if it's effective, right? But, you know, to some degree, it's, you know, criticizing the Beacon advertising program on Facebook. You know, people began to, when Obama set up his sort of, you know, massive campaign site, there was a moment where people began to form groups critiquing a position he had taken. And it was this really interesting problem of, like, are you creating a space where, like, people can have sort of vibrant public discourse? Are you creating a space that's going to get him elected? And when those things sort of didn't work, there was, like, do you then remove? And so removal is its own problem. Not removing is its own problem. So I don't, you know, my tendency is to always say, whenever someone says something is new, you say, when have I seen this before? And it's not as if, like, people didn't organize boycotts against, you know, a network for broadcasting something that they thought was inappropriate. The speed of that was not fast. So, you know, generating a group of people who are going to boycott an advertiser to convince the advertiser to pull, there's a rapid fire response that's possible around these things. So the Amazon fail thing was sort of up and resolved in sort of 2 days. I mean, it was a really fast process, and more visible to Amazon and more problematic to Amazon. And certainly the Kindle removal got, there was a sense that it blew up in their face in a very powerful way. I don't know if I have more comment on it than that, but the ability to use their own platform and the ability to use other platforms of communication is an intriguing piece of this. I guess, I mean, the last thing would be sort of say, I don't know if the story here is that the ability to discern and the ability to make these maneuvers makes this a tighter mechanism, or if it's actually so complex that it's actually a looser mechanism, right? Because the critique is as available as the policy. My sense is that these policies, if they're managed right, happen in a relatively invisible way. And that to me is always tricky.
So when you're talking about earlier about catering to a certain group or age, I'm not so sure that Facebook has set out to cater to anybody other than college kids. And then, you know, the younger siblings, you know, wanted to realize the older ones, and you know, the last high school years wanted to pretend that they were in college and so forth, and down to 10-year-olds. And I suspect you absolutely right that they didn't think, when they created the website, they didn't think more about the 10-year-olds. They thought about the college because they really catered to college. Mm. So can we really hold them responsible? If they're not really catering to a 10-year-old.
Well, I mean, I guess my sense, and there are maybe people in the room who know the history of Facebook better than I do. My sense is that, you know, yes, it began as a university mechanism, but it was only open to university students. Right. When they pushed into a broader audience, when they said we're going to open up our service to people who are older than that, younger than that, have affiliations other than university affiliations, I think we're far enough along that spectrum of sort of institutionalization and the growth of a service that they knew full well that they were expanding their user base, and the expansion towards 13 and older raises all sorts of very particular legal liabilities. Certainly, creeping under 13 raises a whole set of rules for internet sites. So it you know, they had a nice built-in thing where, according to the norms and rules of college, they weren't getting people under, say, 16, and that wasn't true anymore. So whether or not we should hold them responsible, we do, right? I mean, I think we do. It changes the expectations in the law, and it changes the expectations in the culture. I don't think they were unaware of that move. That doesn't mean that they were savvy at every step about doing it the right way. I think they were caught off guard by some of the ways in which high school students picked up Facebook in ways that their college siblings weren't, and used it in different ways than was expected. But I don't know if, it would be a tough sell in my mind to say, well, as long as you think of your audience as 21, then you only have to be treated as providing something for 21-year-olds if that's not, in fact, the case.
It's sort of like if we get a survey and we find out that late night TV is now watched by 5-year-olds, does the TV station have the responsibility to adjust to it, or does the parents have the responsibility to turn it off and put them to bed?
That's a very good question. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, yeah, that's intriguing. And I think the other factor is, does the provider on its own decide to act differently? And I think that's in part what I'm looking at more closely, although the piece of, like, where do you hold responsible? But the piece that I'm looking at is these sites will begin to think of themselves differently, right? YouTube, in that press release, is thinking of itself differently and saying, we're gonna make noise, whether it's performative or substantive, it's hard to judge. We're going to make an explicit statement about addressing the community differently for a sense of what the community is right now or what we'd like it to be. And that, you know, I think those moments where someone discovers that, you know, we put it late night, that was the whole point, and yet it turns out that, you know, a large portion of the audience is under 10, I think a network would begin to think about that differently because they would recognize the kind of cultural pitfalls that they could run into, while also saying, you know, also using strategically the, like, we said this was a safe area, so this isn't our responsibility. I think both happen simultaneously.
But do we as a society have the right to hold the bank to our different rules because all the teenagers went and opened accounts there?
Yeah, I mean that's the hardest question that I'm least ready to put an answer for. Because no, because I think the answer would come out of my own politics and not out of an assessment of what's going on. But you know, I think this is where it points back to: we have a tradition of thinking about where free speech rules go, where regulation based on age goes, how those things run into each other, and there's a philosophical debate about whether that free speech is kind of like, don't draw a line over here. The rest of it is like, it's out there and you got to face it, and parents can regulate it to where they want to. Some people are willing to say that parenting strategies are violations of free speech, but certainly a more common position about, you know, do we expect things of providers for them to create the public discourse, or we simply say, don't get in the way of something that you're not supposed to get in the way of.
So I speak directly to that. I'm from South Africa. I've just done a study at Duke University with business school in South Africa. And this issue of a broadcaster, we have four public channels. Three of them are owned by the public broadcaster. One's a private channel. And the private channel used to be 60% Warner Brothers owned, and it's now actually managed to turn around its business model purely from revenue generation from broadcasting pornography, what from predominantly the US, broadcast on a Friday and Saturday night on its free-to-air service for approximately 3 to 4 hours every Friday and Saturday night. From 2001 to current day, when it started, these questions came up. Who's there to police the who's there to protect the child? The broadcaster responded by saying, we'll introduce a watershed period. And so it'll be after 9 or 10 or eventually 11 o'clock. And the broadcaster has managed to generate so much of revenue from advertising in that pornography slot that it's literally managed to buy out Warner Brothers. It's now fully South African owned, and it refuses to take into account the fact that there's now evidence to prove that pornography on television is the greatest contributor to the level of child-on-child sexual violence in South Africa. So yes, we all know South Africa is one of the adult rape capitals of the world, baby rape capitals of the world. It's now become one of the highest levels of child-on-child sexual abuse, where literally you have 12-year-olds raping 7-year-olds, 7-year-olds raping 3-year-olds. And in some of the very few studies that have been generated, when you ask the question, where's been your first exposure or your greatest exposure to pornography, children are saying television. It's on TV, it's in my home. The question then to the broadcaster was, can you see it? It's no longer the prudes and the and just, you know, religious fundamentalists that are saying take this off our screens. It's any parent anywhere. The state also has an obligation, because with more than 250,000 AIDS orphans, the state is not the parent of the child, where children are not able to have their viewing habits policed by, you know, who's the parent. So we've actually been fighting this this child pornography legislation. And the broadcaster has managed to hold government ransom. The last legislation that was passed, they refused to be censored in that way. And now we have this terribly unfair situation where the rules that apply to a video store and internet service providers are not able to apply to broadcasters. They're claiming it's freedom of speech, which was constitutionally protected based on apartheid versus post-apartheid. And they're literally utilizing this loophole in the law to make their money, to broadcast pornography, and to claim no responsibility for what happens to children, even in the face of children having no level of protection, no means to mediate what they're seeing.
Right, right.
But where is the state for the children that are held by the state whose parents died from AIDS? Where do they get an access to television at 11 o'clock at night?
One of the strategies of the ANC government to respond to the AIDS crisis was not to remove children from their homes and place them in foster care, but to actually keep them in their houses, the houses that their parents struggled and died for and left for them. And television is free. And your television is, you know.
But how do they maintain their loop if they're paying for their expenses?
That's a whole
I understand, but that's, there has to be some kind of adult. You know, 7-year-old cannot.
They do. You have a 12-year-old who's looking after three siblings. and in many cases has to leave school to become the breadwinner, and that is the parent. In some cases, you have an adoptive grandparent who would be installed in the house. Or at times, you know, three of us are the neighbors, and we will check in on the children to make sure that they're okay.
But then again, maybe that's the grandparent's responsibility to put kids to bed at 11 o'clock and not let them watch TV.
If there is a grandparent, I'm just saying that if there is an adult available, yes, it would be the, it could be their responsibility. But let's put television aside. We have the other issue where Africa as a whole has currently gone through has experienced a 1,300% increase in the adoption of mobile technology. So one of the questions that came up from my study at Duke was, in terms of the list of countries that has the highest search rates for the word porn, South Africa is at the top of the list. In terms of print content, apparently South Africa, there's a special type of hustler or print pornographic content that is made specifically for South Africa that is called the gold edition that doesn't even get distributed anywhere else in the world. So some of the questions that we have to ask are, whose responsibility is it when you are aware that a country is facing a human rights violation, or women face human rights violations every single day? There was a certain point in time where an African woman had a greater chance of being raped than getting an education. Well, one out of every four men in a BBC reported study June last year said one out of every South African man has committed rape. Whose responsibility is it for deciding on what type of stimulus, if you know that there is a relationship between pornography and sexual aggression, for making sure that that gets into the country, whether it's via print or television or internet?
Well, and one of the things that's interesting here is that you're watching a question of strategies and justifications,
but going in both directions, right? So in the sites that I'm looking at, sites that are articulating their criteria so as to include as much that sort of pushes the boundaries, or sites that are articulating and clarifying to have less, right? And you know, without undercutting the questions of the imperative of thinking about you know, what sort of hardcore material, what its relationship to social fabric is. You know, I'm finding the question on the opposite end. So not the question of like, what about, you know, obscenely horrifying child pornography, but, you know, Facebook facing a question about whether images of women breastfeeding cross the line about nudity. So there's a really interesting dilemma on both ends, right? How do you find a barrier or a line to draw in the sand that says we aren't comfortable with this, and we can, and within our justifications, we can resolve a free speech question, we can resolve a sort of what right do we have to intervene question, to intervene, and on the other side say, how do those categories and interventions not become their own kind of de factos, right? So a rule that says no nudity, which is like designed to sort of avoid something that's quite obvious, also then becomes a lever around something that is actually culture contested. And so, you know, to look at the category from both sides, I think it raises a really difficult issue. And that's where these sites are. They're managing both sides of, you know, what they'd like to be able to include, what they feel they are, you know, is publicly acceptable for them to include.
So unfortunately, I have to actually cut this off at this point because we are at time. For those who want to engage more with Tarleton, he'll be around for a little bit.
Sure.
Right after this. Also, we are hosting a Microsoft Research tomorrow at 4 o'clock. From 4 to 5:30 will be sort of a longer talk about his work more broadly. And again, you'd be welcome to hang out and chill with us there. Microsoft Research is located at 1 Memorial Drive down at Kendall, the other end of the Cambridge spectrum. And you're more than welcome. If you have any questions, drop me an email, Dana, D-A-N-A-H, at cyber.law.harvard.edu. But thank you so much, Charles, for having me.
No, I appreciate it.